Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we're talking to Ben Affleck, Chris Tucker, Matt Damon and Marlon Wayans for Air, directors John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein for Dungeons & Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves, and Anya Taylor-Joy about her upcoming role as Princess Peach in the Super Mario Brothers movie. We'll be rating Air, Dungeons & Dragons, Tetris and God's Creatures. Quite a lot on, Matt, and you did most of those chats.
Yes, it was a very busy week for interviews, which is not a bad thing.
But well, have you been watching anything else instead of all of those things? Have you been doing some little side hustle?
Yes, besides all these films, the main thing I've watched this week has been Succession. And I normally struggle to sort of keep up with TV, but this is one I have to watch weekly now because we're into the final season, season four, 10 episodes. And I just can't risk having it spoiled, having kind of invested this time in it. And I was obviously a little bit sad when I heard it was going to be the final season because, you know, I love it. And when you love something, you kind of want it to just last forever. But I actually kind of respect it. And I'm excited that there's, you know, they're going to end it. Hopefully, I mean, I'm hoping on a high. This first episode was very good, very much what I was looking for. Very much started at full speed, full strength, didn't kind of ease its way back in. So it's sort of really great to be back in that world. And yeah, I can't risk spoilers, and I'm just desperate to watch the new episodes really, so that's something I will be watching as it drops every week. But otherwise I'm very behind, because the other thing I've been watching TV wise, which is embarrassingly behind, is The Traitors. Did you watch that when everyone
didn't watch that, and haven't seen a single episode of that. Only saw the comic relief version of it with Dawn French as Claudia Winkleman. So yeah, I that is my only entry point into that show.
So yeah, I hadn't seen anything about it, but a few people just kept saying you've got to watch it. And so months later, obviously, after everyone had gone on about it, I dived in, and it's sort of silly. It's sort of classic reality TV in a lot of ways, but it is ridiculously addictive, compulsive kind of viewing. Like, it's out of everything I've watched in recent years, really, like in terms of just the desperation to watch the next episode has just been ridiculous. You know, and I'm not like a binge watcher typically, but I've just been desperately sort of, you know, gorging on as many episodes as I can, you know. So I've got one left now, so I've just got to try and avoid any spoilers till tonight, really.
Yeah, good. I have been watching on Channel 4 a documentary about Paula Yates called Paula, and how she was treated by the media. And it's obviously pertinent to, you know, the fact that the Amy Winehouse film has just finished filming and will be coming out, and that we are very much in a discussion at the moment about how we treat our celebrities and how complicit we are in that. Recent films about Diana has also explored that. And it's just really fascinating because to me, I'm sure she was to you, she was the lady off The Big Breakfast. And I enjoyed her interviews on the bed and her cheekiness and her flirtatiousness. But I don't think I really understood quite how intelligent and trailblazing she was. And how vilified she was by the press. The idea that, you know, when she loses the love of her life in Michael Hutchins, she flies to Australia with a plane load full of tabloid journalists trying to hiss at her throughout that grieving flight. Just things like that you just think, God, we would not have that happen nowadays, thank goodness. But that at the same time, the insidiousness of media blaming the woman in a relationship for the downfall of a man, you know, that he must have committed suicide because of her. And then the great tragedy that ultimately she later died, as did her daughter Peaches. So it's fascinating. If you're into media and the development of media and you know, fame, it's a fascinating insight. And on the flip side of that, talking about fame and how it's used, been watching Agent Elvis on Netflix. Potty mouth with a very dirty monkey. Scatter the Monkey features prominently, and Priscilla Presley voicing herself is quite a trip to watch. Really enjoying it though. It's great fun.
Awesome.
Shall we get on with what we can watch this week on the big screen? Let's see if this is a shoe-in for Oscar. Did you see what I did there?
See what you did there.
Here we go.
I got it.
I found him.
Who's that? Jesus?
Can't afford it.
I'm willing to bet my career on one guy.
My name's Sonny Vaccaro. I'm with Nike.
Do you typically make it a habit of showing up at people's front doors unannounced?
I don't like to take no for an answer.
Oh, man. Here we go.
You ask me what I do here. This is what I do. I find you players, and I feel it this time. Yeah, okay, it's risky. When you were selling sneakers out of the back of your Plymouth, that was risky. Don't change that now.
For a rookie?
Yes.
Who's never set foot on an NBA court.
That's the literal definition of rookie. Yeah.
So this is Air. Matt, tell us what this is about and who you had a chat to earlier this week.
Okay, so in terms of setting up this film, this is basically the story of the creation of Nike's Air Jordan basketball shoe. Ben Affleck directs the film, and he also plays Nike founder and CEO Phil Knight, but he's largely a supporting role. The main character and sort of driver of the story is Matt Damon as Sonny Vaccaro, and he's a basketball talent scout for Nike. Chris Tucker is one of Sonny's colleagues who deals with the talent there, and Marlon Wayans is George Raveling, who was one of Michael Jordan's Olympic coaches. And this film was set in 1984, a great year, the year I was born. And
they mention that in the film, that Matt Matum's been born somewhere in England.
There's this montage at the beginning, and I was kind of hoping for a mention, but sadly not. But anyway, yes, it's very, very much set in like this very loud, broad 80s milieu. And it's just, it's just basically the story of Sonny, Matt Damon's character, trying to sign this young, sort of promising looking basketball player called Michael Jordan. We sort of find Nike at a time where they're doing great with running shoes, but their basketball division is sort of pretty rubbish. They're looking to invest in a few, perhaps, you know, not particularly inspiring players, but Sonny is basically saying, no, look, let's just take all our budget and sort of bet the farm on this young Michael Jordan. And that's what the story is about, basically.
So you sat down with the filmmakers and the cast.
So I spoke to all those four names mentioned: Ben Affleck, Chris Tucker, Matt Damon, Marlon Wayans. There's a few more kind of notable actors in supporting roles in this film as well, but these are some of the key characters. It's very much a sort of ensemble film, really, following Sonny as he goes through this journey.
Shall we have a listen to what they have to say about the film? Here's Matt talking to Ben and Matt and Marlon and Chris.
I need the greatest basketball shoe that's ever been made.
Who's the player?
Michael Jordan. You're motoring.
Ben, you're the director of this film, and you also appear as Nike CEO Phil Knight. Is your leadership style anything like Phil's? And Chris, perhaps you could comment on that as well.
You know, one of the things about this movie is that I didn't purport to be the expert on every little facet of exactly what happened. It's a kind of an inspiration. Admittedly, we take liberties, and admittedly, we kind of made as much a sort of fable as anything else, because it's really about a character, on the one who never appears in the movie, in Michael Jordan, because I felt that he's just too iconic, recognizable, and kind of special, where you immediately would know the whole thing was a lie if I tried to tell you somebody else was Michael Jordan. And that fundamentally, what I love about it, it's actually about the person that I feel guided him and who serves to represent women like her all over the world, particularly the United States, and who are in that position, how important they are. Really, it was more kind of like I looked at Phil Knight, and not in terms of trying to calibrate myself exactly to him. You know, I knew that he was going to have to be the one resisting the desire for taking big risks, because he was a risk taker who now was responsible for the whole ship. What I was really interested in and liked about the character was the way that he was influenced by traveling in the East and by religions like Buddhism, but also found that those tenets often ran completely counter to running a giant capitalist organization. And so I was trying to reconcile that, you know, we got some humor and absurdity out of.
And Ben is being modest. He showed the movie to Phil Knight, and Phil Knight loved it and said he caught the spirit of what was going on in 84 in that company in Nike. I'm friends with Howard White, and I just was blessed and lucky that I knew him before I found out, you know, I found out about the role and the movie, and Matt and Ben was doing this movie, and then they said, Howard White, they want you to play Howard White. I said, what? I know Howard White. I met him years ago with Michael Jordan at one of Michael's golf tournaments in the Bahamas somewhere.
You're like, good, because you have to write the part too.
Yeah, because they said the part, it ain't really a part, you know. I said, cool, and Ben said, you know, we, you can do, we'll work with you. We can do whatever you want to make it work. I said, cool. And, you know, working with those guys, I knew I'd be in safe hands. And I called Howard, my friend, and I said, hey, man, this is a movie they're doing, and I think you're in it. He said, yeah, I heard about that. I said, but, I too many things I like, you know, working with Ben and Matt is one that was a positive. Sports, Michael Jordan, I love that. And then, of course, it was my friend. So Howard took me back when he was 5 years old, had me talking to about 40 people about his life, and all of them said the same thing about him, that he was this great guy. He was like Confucius. He was brilliant. And Howard just schooled me. He really helped me a lot on the part. So I think I captured his spirit by being a positive guy and, you know, looking at the glass half full instead of half empty. And that's who he is to this day, man. And people love Howard White.
I was reading, Ben, that when you met Michael Jordan, Howard White was one of the characters that Michael said he wanted to appear in this film. What was it about Howard that was sort of so important for Michael?
But I had gotten a chance to meet him a few times over time, which is how I was able to kind of, you know, get a hold of him to say, hey, can you give me an hour of your time, and asking you, hey, what matters to you? Because I don't want to violate anything. I have to change things. I have to condense things. I got to tell a story that moves people. But in doing that, I don't want to change anything fundamentally true to that's meaningful to you. And he didn't have a big laundry list. He was not a guy who was overly concerned about, make me look this way or that. He actually was very generous in the sense that what he cared about was other people. He wanted George Raveling to be a part of the story because he felt Raveling was very essential to his coming to Nike. He played on the Olympic team with Raveling, which takes place before the events of this movie. So that's why I wanted Marlon to play that character, so you got that sense. He didn't say to me what it is about Howard that made him feel so close to him, and he's still friends with him to this day. But in meeting Howard, it's very evident he's kind of like the sage of Nike. He walks around. He's like, everybody looks up to him, whether you're the chairman of the board or Phil. You know, when Howard speaks, you know, I've been told well-liked and respected people at the company in the history of the company. What qualities does he have that make him that way? I don't know. I mean, he started off being the guy who's responsible for, you know, kind of welcoming the players there and making them feel comfortable and at home. And it's really one of his great gifts is his capacity to make you feel as though he likes you and understands you and is patient. He's funny. He's a storyteller. And he's a believer. He really is that scene. A lot of the stuff Chris did, I mean, he worked on this so hard to really embody this character. And so those words are really right out of Howard's mouth. You know, that when he sits down and says, you know, you made me believe. He is that guy who talks that way.
And Marlon, Michael Jordan had said that George Raveling was kind of a very important figure to appear in this film. Why was he so important to Michael?
He trusted him. You know, as a black man, it's hard when you're walking into these industries and you have these, no offense, Matt, these white people pitching you stuff. We've been done so wrong, like we don't trust, instinctually, we don't trust. And so to have somebody that you can trust on the other side, faces that you can trust, and they give you that nod like you're in good hands. I think that was important to Michael, even as a youth and throughout his career. So I think Raveling was one of the people that he respected.
And did the two of you get to meet your counterparts in real life?
No, I didn't get to meet mine.
I talked to Sonny before we started shooting, and then I met him. He came to the set towards the very end. And so I got to meet him in person, but I Zoomed with him early on, which was really helpful, helping me contextualize where his head was during this time and what those dynamics were with the other people. Like, you know, George Raveling was his best friend, and, you know, he was, you know, our best man at Sonny's wedding. You know, he was they were very, very close at that time. And you know, interestingly, you know, all of these relationships took these turns after this time, after the time the movie ends. And, you know, so it's interesting that everybody that we talked to who was around at that time said, no, but this time was kind of unabashed collaboration and joy. And that's really how the nostalgia with which they remember that time.
I'm completely jealous because I reached out to George Raveling and he didn't pick up. And then I reached out to his son, who also didn't pick up. And then my brother Damon had met George Raveling, and I called Damon, and he too didn't pick up.
And Ben, you've obviously been friends and collaborators with Matt Damon going way back. So what was it like? This was your first time actually.
I like to think of it as he's been riding my tail for a long time, but whatever.
And so I was going to say, what was it like actually directing him? And Chris, again, what was it like kind of seeing that sort of relationship from your perspective?
Honestly, like the thing about working with your friends is that it's actually the way that you should work with everybody else, which is they should feel like it's easy. You like them. There's no pressure. It's just us, you know, and be relaxed and feel supported. Because I only know that's what I want as an actor. And that's how I feel I do my best work. So really, the way I work with Matt is just the same way with everybody else, which is not to be a dictator. I think people sometimes have this vision of the director with the beret and the bullhorn and, you know, the stick. I really feel like your job as a director is to create an environment where people feel comfortable enough to take risks, where they feel at ease, they forget about the camera, where they feel comfortable going, you know what, I thought maybe we try this, because that's where those are gifts. And particularly this movie with people with life experiences different from mine, whose voices, you know, I couldn't tell, like, what's the authentic voice here? And I have wonderful actors to help me. I have wonderful crew also that you're being a director is being smart. If you're good, you'll listen to people and pick out the great ideas that you get from others.
It was great working with Matt and Ben. Their friendship, you know, of course I knew about it, but they just made you feel comfortable. I tell the story about they came into my trailer one time and say, hey man, it's just like friends making a movie. We're just gonna have fun. We're just messing around. And I was like, cool, because that's how I like to work. You know, we're gonna figure it out. And take those chances and risks, man. And they made it just so comfortable for everybody. It was like, it was just like that. Friends making a movie. And that's when the best stuff comes, you know, from my stand-up days doing stand-up comedy. Sometimes I get on the stage and I don't know what I'm going to say. And I'm just relaxed and the crowd is with you. And then the best stuff comes out. So I felt that in this movie. And of course, a lot of preparation. But man, it was so much fun on the set.
And Marlon, what was it like kind of seeing that relationship from your perspective?
I found it cute, right? Because I know their story, right? I know that they're best friends and it was cute. It was like when Ben would give Matt direction, Matt would look up from his page like, yeah, I know. And Ben was like, okay. And they just had like this shorthand and I just found it like, it was cute. It was like, you know, two brothers working together. And I felt like between the two of them, it wasn't Matt's performance they were concerned with. I really felt like they both were there for the supporting cast. Like they get each other, but they made this a safe space between Ben and Matt for Marlon to create and have fun as Raveling. And they invited me into the playground and shared the toys. And we had a good time. And it was a great experience. I would tell any actor, hey, y'all need to do that movie.
Well, also Marlon's being modest because every ad lib he came up with is in the movie. So he was writing the scene as we were shooting it. So yeah, we definitely invited him into the playground. But that was
I was surprised that as many ad libs. I was like, oh, they kept that. I was like, they kept that too. Man, I do more of these movies.
And Matt, how did you find it actually being directed by Ben this time?
It was great. I mean, it was a natural extension of, you know, writing scripts with somebody, you're basically doing creative problem solving all day long. So it wasn't an unfamiliar position to be in with him. You know, it just felt like the very natural progression of, you know, working together. He is a great director. And I say that because of what Marlon's talking about, that environment that he creates. It's like he really gets the best out of everyone. He, I think, wisely believes that casting is really 95% of the job. And then once you do that, you really got to put these people that you cast in a position to just be free and do their best work. And so that's what he did. And, you know, leaving myself out of it, I think the work speaks for itself, like looking at what all these other actors brought. I mean, it's a really impressive ensemble of actors.
And what do you think the trick is when it comes to making a film like this, that basically everyone really knows the outcome of the story? But what's the trick to then making the film kind of, you know, compelling and engaging and gripping?
The outcome, you know, the Titanic's going to sink too. I think it's about the writing and the acting, you know, and if you care about the characters, you know, you feel that what those stakes are, you want them to be successful. And those are the kind of movies that Ben and I grew up loving. Like movies that were performance driven and that were, you know, that's why we wanted to be actors and that's how we wound up being writers too. You know, that's one of the reasons we wanted to start this company was to make movies like this. the kind of movies that don't seem to be getting made as much, or they at least seem to be very difficult to get made, you know, but we don't want to see them go away. You know, we want to see movies like this still thriving like they were in the 90s.
Yeah, it's a human story, right? We're so used to having these superheroes, you know, saving the world and, you know, the Avengers and, you know, and it's good to just have a nice everyday human story about a guy with a dream that wants to make it happen. And this way, everybody that watches that movie, we all become Sonny. You know, we all feel like at a point you're like, yeah, I want to make this deal happen. Never mind what everybody's saying. Everybody's always going to feed you negativity because they want to protect you. But when you have a dream, you have something that you want to do, you just want to get it done. And it feels good to see them be successful. And then you look at how big the brand has become and you really feel like, wow, you know, trust your instincts.
So that is Ben, Matt, Chris and Marlon talking about Air. What did you think of it, Matt? Did you like it? Were you even aware of this story before you went into this film?
Well, I was obviously aware of Air Jordan as like a massive brand. Also aware of Michael Jordan going on to become obviously one of the greatest sports greatest sports people of all time, basically in any field. But I'm not a basketball fan. I'm not like a Michael Jordan stan or anything like that. I haven't even watched that documentary, The Last Dance. This is how bad I am at keeping up with TV, but obviously aware of his status in the world. But I didn't know the ins and outs of this story. But I think even if you come at it like me, you basically know what's going to happen. You know what the outcome's going to be, really. Perhaps I even approach this with a degree of cynicism because I felt a bit like, right, it sounds very corporate. Do we really need a film sort of celebrating the invention of this massively sort of successful product, basically? But then I really, really got sort of swept up in it, and I thought it was just extremely sort of slickly put together, very well cast, just had that sort of that knack for like making you care about the thing that you know is going to happen anyway and making you invested, drawing you in. It's not at all gritty. It's very, very sort of frothy light. It's funny. It sort of verges on comedy in places, and Ben Affleck obviously plays it very sort of comedically as the zen-like sort of founder of this massive sort of corporation. Yeah, I just really liked it, really. How about you?
I felt conflicted. I like all the things that you're saying. I think it is, you know, very slickly done. It's always a pleasure to watch those actors. And we didn't mention that Chris Messina is in it as this sort of cutthroat agent of Jordan. Viola Davis is Jordan's mother, who is a key sort of figure in this deal as well. And although it's about, you know, the creation of an iconic shoe and the start of an iconic career, it's also about artists understanding their own worth and asking for it and not being prepared to sell out to a corporation. So, you know, in that respect, you could, you know, Taylor Swift's probably going to love this too. You know, that idea is quite interesting. But I did find a sticking point, which I know is an artistic decision on Affleck's part, that we don't see Jordan at all in this. He remains this completely opaque, shadowy figure that is talked about in every room. And even when he does appear, he's very awkwardly turned to the side. His head is turned, so you cannot see his face. And I know that Affleck's talked about that in a way that he says, you know, he couldn't cast anyone as this titan of sport, that he's too charismatic, he's too iconic for anyone to inhabit. But like, Ben, you know, we've managed to do that with other, you know, that's Austin Butler, you know, managed to do it. Will Smith managed to do it with Ali, you know, like we can do this. It is possible. You don't have to, you know, have him being a central figure, but because he's so sort of shadowy and not there, and even when he is there, he's not there, it became a real distraction for me. And it's sort of become a thing. I think they've probably knocked it on the head now. More people have seen it, but people were worried about this being a sort of a white savior movie. And that, why are we having a film about this incredible black athlete being told through the lens of the white middle-aged men who had created a shoe? And yeah, you can put those sort of doubts to rest somewhat, but it's still a weird decision to me. And I found it very, very distracting.
Yeah, I didn't mind it too much. I was sort of somewhere on the fence. I know some people spoke to someone after the screening who said that they completely agreed with it because they just felt like that you couldn't capture, you know, his aura and energy. and that almost by not having him there, you know, the real guy's aura kind of played into the film. But I was kind of somewhere in the middle where it didn't bother me too much. But I agree with you that the scenes that he is in are slightly awkward, where you've got that, you know, just the back of his head. And it's just, I feel like there could have been perhaps a better way around that side of things, just not included him at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to kind of take me out of it. And I suppose as well, maybe it would have bothered me more if it was a more serious, hard-hitting kind of drama. But because it is played so light, it's sort of, it's this very wiggy sort of very 80s, you know, like plays up that, you know, in the costume. So it's this very broad, you know, idea of the 80s.
Yeah, with like grape-coloured Porsches. Yeah. And shell suits and you know, really obvious needle drops.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was just one of those films I just felt on board with almost immediately. Just something about it, just I went in a bit cynical, but I was just swept up almost immediately. Some people perhaps will find it too cheesy, too obvious, but there is something satisfying about when films play out in this way, and when you come to it with that knowledge of what's going to happen and you see how things go, and there's the you know, the kind of ironic dialogue and things like that. I just found it very enjoyable, and it felt to me, I know some people started this sort of best picture chat for it after
it's getting Oscar going around it.
I mean, there's obviously big talk, and then this talk starts earlier every year, but this is insanely early for it to start. So obviously I've got no idea on that front. And obviously when you say, oh, this is a best picture contender, it makes it sound like you're saying, oh, this is like the best film of the year, which I don't think is the case. But I wouldn't rule it out in the sense that it feels to me like one of those films you could almost put on for anyone, like anyone in your family, and you would just kind of enjoy it because the story just is compelling and it's kind of relatable. Yeah, even if you know nothing about basketball. Yeah, it's fun. It's sort of broad. I think it's one of those real, real crowd pleasers, really, which... broad, you know, unsubtle, but hard for, I think, you know, not to like in some way.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of The Big Short. It's a load of really talented actors making a subject that could be quite dense in terms of, you know, they talk a lot about basketball and moves and, you know, and things that I know nothing about, and make it very accessible and sort of easy to digest. And I think a lot of that is to do with Matt Damon. He's just... generally, you root for him when he's an underdog. And I just think he's perfect casting for this. I like this a whole lot more than the last Damon Affleck reunion film, The Last Duel. I liked the wigs a great deal more and the accents certainly a great deal more. So, yeah, for me, I'd rather see Matt and Ben do this than do their whatever they thought they were doing in Ridley Scott's historical epic.
Yeah, and they do get some very enjoyable scenes together here, even though Ben doesn't have a huge role. Yeah, they do share some really fun moments.
There is another underdog great corporation story set in the 80s that's out this week, but I think we're saying so far in this discussion, Air is the one to go for then. We should be spending our money at the cinema on this one, yes?
Well, I very much recommend it, yeah. Highly entertaining.
Air is out next Wednesday on the 5th of April. Right, from one gang of underdogs to another. It's this.
Truth be told, we helped the wrong person steal the wrong thing. We didn't mean to unleash the greatest evil the world has ever known. But we're gonna fix it.
So how do we pull that off? Figure it out over a drink?
Probably best.
You need cooling!
Then give us a fighting chance. We're gonna need strength. You got this, right?
I know you don't.
We also need courage. Back to school. Magic. And you.
So this is Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, which sets it up for a franchise. Matt, you talked to the filmmakers. Who did you talk to and what did you talk about?
I did. So this was my second interview of the week, which was with the directors, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, who previously did Game Night, a very sort of fun. And I mean, some people say underrated comedy, but now I think it's people...
It's a rated comedy. Rated.
People really like it. It's one of the best kind of comedies really of recent years. Just straight kind of, you know, fun, pure comedy. It's absolutely great. And check it out if you haven't seen it yet. But yeah, so they did that. And then Yeah, so this is obviously an adaptation of the Dungeons and Dragons board games, which are huge. And it's a thing, surprisingly, which has completely passed me by in my life, because obviously I was like a nerdy child growing up, but for some reason never fell into the sort of role-playing games. So I come to this as a Dungeons and Dragons newbie. The film, to kind of sum it up, it's a big world. And as you get in fantasy, there's a lot of different kind of factions, different parts of the world. But what we're ultimately sort of looking at is a fantasy spin on a heist movie. And at the center, you have Chris Pine, who is Edgin, who is a bard character from, you know, which is a type of character you get in the game, a kind of storyteller, singer. And he was formerly a harper, which seems to be a bit like a sort of a spy or secret agent of this world. And we learn a bit about his backstory and why he's ended up raising his young daughter alone, or at least he had been until he ends up in a sort of snowy prison, which is where we find him and Michelle Rodriguez's Holger, who is a barbarian, where they're kind of in prison there at the beginning of the film. And they sort of hatch an escape plot to sort of reunite Edgin with his daughter. And they team up with this big ensemble of sort of various different fantasy characters. So that's kind of, you know, that's the introduction to the film there. So shall we listen to the interview?
Yes, let's hear what they had to say.
What is it exactly that you bring to this?
I'm a planner. I make plans.
You've already made the plan, so...
If the existing plan fails, I make a new plan.
So you make plans that fail?
No.
He also plays the lute.
Not relevant.
So I'm delighted to welcome the directors of Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, John Francis Daly.
Hello.
And Jonathan Goldstein.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast and thanks very much for joining us. And to kick things off, when you first began work on Dungeons & Dragons, what did you feel were the essential elements to make it a Dungeons & Dragons movie as opposed to just being, you know, another fantasy movie?
The biggest element for us was that it captured the spirit of the game, which is all about spontaneity, unpredictability, solving problems on the fly, and the fun of it, frankly, mm-hmm. because we've seen any number of shows and movies in the fantasy realm that have been deadly serious. And we felt there was an unrepresented corner of the genre, which is so, you know, baked into the DNA of D&D. I don't think they were taking it entirely seriously when they created a gelatinous cube.
And how did you kind of maintain that tone throughout? Because like you say, it is very funny, but it's not sort of snarky and not sort of, you know, taking the mic of itself. So what was your sort of North Star when it came to the tone?
Well, we have a deep reverence and respect for the game. And I think that helps to keep us from being cynical about it. I think often a big mistake that people make when they want to approach something comedically is to really take the piss out of it and not take it as seriously as it should be taken. I think you can take source material seriously and also find a lot of humor in it. And so it's finding that balance where our characters are always justified. They're never breaking the fourth wall of what their characters would say or do. Mm-hmm. But they also can have a sense of humor about things and they can encounter humorous situations without it feeling like we're betraying the source material.
They can have an awareness of some of the more absurd aspects of the world they're in, just as the viewer does watching it today. And so we didn't feel like they have to just accept everything at face value. They can question it and say, why are there five questions? I don't know. It's arbitrary.
And on that note, when it sort of comes to the characters, you mentioned to another one of our writers a while back that it was sort of unusual to have a bard as the sort of lead character. Could you kind of unpack that a bit more and then explain sort of why you went down that path?
I think we liked the idea of exploring a less traditional depiction of what a hero is in one of these films. And bards are kind of silly. they're storytellers. They are entertainers. They probably have a bit of an ego. And in the case of Chris Pine's character, he has this relentless optimism that is so winning when you're watching the movie because they face a lot of roadblocks. They fail almost nonstop, but it's all in how you approach those moments of failure that it either be sad or motivating.
It also gave us an opportunity to have a co-lead with the bard in the form of Holger the Barbarian, Michelle Rodriguez's character, who is, you know, very tough physically and completely in a platonic partnership with Chris's character, which we hadn't seen very much.
And that's another thing that is sort of really interesting about this lineup of characters in the film, is that none of them are sort of quite what you expect in the way that, like you say, Michelle Rodriguez is a barbarian, but she's sort of nursing a broken heart and has this really sort of caring instinct. And then Justice Smith is a sorcerer, but he's not kind of the most skilled. Right. So was that kind of key to cracking the film?
Yeah, for sure. We wanted to make sure that the characters we're following are relatable, even though they're in this very foreign world. They have to be people kind of like you might know, someone who has flaws, who lacks confidence, who has a broken relationship that burdens them.
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite movies and television are ones with characters that are deeply flawed, at least in the beginning of the story. I mean, The British Office is a perfect example of a lot of people that are, you know, considered somewhat of losers, but you see a little bit of them in yourself and it makes you feel a little bit better for not being a perfect person. And that, I think, is just more real.
And for not working in Slough.
And kind of without going into spoilers, there's a sort of a cameo in this film, but sort of how did that come about? Was that kind of an existing relationship you have with this person, or were they a fan of the game?
Yeah, I did have an existing relationship with him. We worked on a show together when I was 19 or 20.
Oh, wow.
And had kept in touch. And then when we made the film, we thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if he played this character? And so we sent him the unfinished work in progress of our movie. He saw it, and I think he immediately saw the appeal of the movie and how it was kind of different. And so jumped at the opportunity, and we were so lucky to have him because he's clearly an incredibly skilled actor.
Dave Boreanaz, wasn't it?
And it's one of those things where it's kind of funny at first, the sort of surprise bit, but then it's actually played quite straight as well, isn't it? Yeah. Was that kind of part of the fun of it for you as
Absolutely.
Well?
That was always the intention. Mm-hmm. We wanted sort of a very recognizable face in that role. So when the door opens, it's a shock. Mm-hmm. But then the scene itself is not meant to play comedically. People are laughing, which is fine. But it really is just played for a straight emotional kind of beat in the movie.
Yeah, it was never intended to be purely a gimmick.
And there were a couple of sequences in this film as well that reminded me of something from your previous film, Game Night. And there's this really memorable scene in Game Night where the characters are sort of trying to get away with this Fabergé egg and they're sort of running around the house, throwing it to each other mm-hmm. in this sort of big sequence. And a couple of moments made me think about that in Dungeons and Dragons, but particularly the sequence where Sophia Lillis's character, Doric, is involved in sort of chase and she's changing into different forms. Was that, did you think about that, you know, think back on that Game Night sequence when
Absolutely.
You were constructing?
Yeah, that was fully intentional. We decided our lives were too easy, so we're going to do one of those in every movie, and it's always hard as hell.
It put half of the gray hairs on my head. But no, I think what's funny is that was one of the first things that we actually pitched the studio when we were approached to work on this film, because it felt like such a perfect example of how to find the cinematic appeal of the game and utilize what is so unique about the game, and specifically this character's ability to wild shape into different animals and creatures.
And what is the trick in your minds of staging this kind of set piece that takes place in sort of constant motion like this?
It has to be approached from first with the question of, is this justified? We don't want to do it just for flash. There has to be a compelling reason to complicate things by making it a oneer. And a chase inherently feels uninterrupted and so lends itself to be covered without any cuts, without the relief of seeing things from someone else's perspective. So you really become immersed in it. Hopefully by the time it's over, you don't even think about the fact that it's a oneer. You're just thinking that you have somehow embodied this character that's trying to get away.
And something else that I really appreciated in this film was that you could really see there was like real locations, real sets, sort of real practical effects in there. How did you sort of balance that with obviously the needs of certain things to be digital? Like what was your kind of guiding principle there?
Well, when we set out to do the movie, we were very clear that we wanted to include as many real locations and practical effects as possible. We didn't want to just fall back on the blue screen world and also because we wanted it to connect to sort of visually to some of the movies that we loved from the 80s and 90s, which did have more reliance on practical effect. Obviously, it's in some ways more challenging because there's animatronics, prosthetics involved, there's people manipulating the parts, and a lot of actually high-tech aspects to those animatronics now, which can go wrong on the day.
And did.
Sometimes did. You know, it's just, I think it's a different feel. I think the audience can feel the difference. Also, where you're in real locations, we took full advantage of Northern Ireland. We went all over the map to get, you know, cliffs and these beautiful beaches and forest and everything we could to showcase it. Because otherwise, why go there?
You know? Yeah, I think audiences appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into it. But of course, we weren't able to do it without having a team of experts and artists who took it all very seriously and put their heart and souls in it. And I think you can kind of see that.
And it feels like as well that for audiences, when you see something that is real, it almost makes the CG sort of stuff look better and more convincing. I don't know, trick of the eye.
That's always the most effective, is where you don't quite know where the line is between what was really there and where we've added.
It's sort of a parallel to magic tricks. In that you can be distracted by one element that may be more real or tangible, that you're not even paying attention to the part that is impossible to pull off practically.
We've learned the value of foreground elements. So you have something close to camera and it doesn't look fake when it's back in the distance.
What's the trick for this kind of film to making like the world feel so big? Because in all the best kind of fantasy or sci-fi films, thinking back to things like, you know, the original Star Wars, even, you just get this feeling that it's a much bigger world than even, you know, what you see in that one film.
I can draw a sort of a peculiar parallel to the show The Wire, which immerses you immediately into this world of crime in Baltimore without spelling everything out for you. So in the first few episodes, even the way characters are speaking is almost impossible to understand, but you have a certain sense of what's going on. And without patronizing or indoctrinating the audience, you're kind of plunging them into this world, knowing that eventually they're going to kind of get their bearings and understand it almost on a subconscious level.
But the Star Wars comparison is very apt because that is how we approached it. We wanted you to feel like there is this much larger world around you that you're not going to see in this movie. You'll get little inklings of, but it's really about our characters moving through their own journey. That was our hope, that would be the feeling you'd have.
And did you have any sort of favorite little side characters that are just kind of glimpsed throughout the film that we don't really spend a lot of time with?
The beggar, the dragonborn beggar who John does the voice of was a great one. It was originally going to be a Gripply, which is a little frog person, but we didn't have the money at that point to create it just for one line. But I love that. I love the idea that, you know, he's just a dragonborn, he's fallen on hard times.
I think it's always fun, much like in Star Wars, to get glimpses of these otherworldly creatures without spending too much time understanding them or getting to know them. For instance, another creature I thought was fun to see was the rust monsters that are fighting over a rusty padlock that have absolutely nothing to do with the story, but you just get a sense that there's a lot going on behind the scenes, behind the characters', you know, primary stories.
And sort of thinking about that bigger world, to what extent were you thinking about sort of the franchise potential of building out the world and possible future installments or spin-offs?
Honestly, like that wasn't our consideration in doing this. We know there is a huge world that is in the lore of D&D after 50 years, but it wasn't anything where we planted a little Easter egg, which we can come back to in a second movie. Yeah.
Despite the fact that this movie has a colon in its title, we never looked at it with the overambitious intention to create a trilogy. That said, if we were so lucky for this movie to be a success and they want to do more, we would jump at the chance because we've grown to love these characters and know that there's so much potential in the world that hasn't yet been explored.
They wanted to call it Dungeons and Dragons Begins, and we said no.
That's not true.
And does the nature of the games kind of, because I'm someone who's not familiar with the games at all, does that lend itself to that feeling of expansion, I guess, because people are playing different campaigns and there's
absolutely
different.
It's an ever-evolving beast, and no one campaign is the same as the last. People play it differently. They bend the rules. And so there's limitless potential
to explore in terms of like finding stories that haven't been told before in locations that you haven't quite seen.
And another big film this year that will have at least some of your fingerprints on it is The Flash, on which you retain this story credit. Like, how far did you get down the road with that? And kind of, do you see any traces of your work in any of the footage that's been released so far? Or does it feel like they've taken it in a very different direction?
Well, we saw the movie it does. I would say the first half follows pretty closely the template that we had. And then it goes in somewhat of a different direction. But we really liked what they did with it. Christina Hodson and Andy Muschietti, I think, made a movie that's surprisingly emotional. It's funny. And we have no complaints.
So that is John and Jonathan talking about Dungeons and Dragons, which I'm a newbie to, as well as you, Matt. Did you like it? Did it work for you? Has it got you going out to buy the board game?
Well, I don't know if it'll get me playing the board game, but as you may have gathered from the interview, I really, really enjoyed this film. And again, went in with sort of reasonable hopes because I like the look of it and I'd heard good things from some other people. But so sometimes you worry that's raised your expectations too high. But I just found it just immensely enjoyable. And I just realized I said the same thing about Air, but it was one of those films that immediately won me over from that sort of snowy prison setting that I sort of said about. I just loved the sort of feel of the world. I loved that there was some sort of practical makeup going on early on. And then I really like the characters in this film, like Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez being the kind of most central characters, perhaps. But Chris Pine is one of those people, he never perhaps would come up in, if I was thinking about my favorite actors, but he's just like, he's just a genuine movie star. He's just really good at this sort of stuff. And Michelle Rodriguez, obviously great. I thought they kind of cast it really well. I like the fact that none of the characters were quite what you expect in a way. So Michelle Rodriguez is this barbarian, but she's sort of nursing a bit of a broken heart and has a real sort of sensitive side. Justice Smith is this sorcerer who isn't very good at magic. So there's sort of a lot of fun there. Reggae Jean Page, he's this sort of, you know, this kind of almost ultimate hero type character, but that's played for a lot of sort of ironic fun. And I just found it very fun, very charming. Felt like a sort of throwback blockbuster in that sense to me, where it was just funny, fun. You could get into it without, and this is a key thing, but you can get into it without really knowing anything about the world, the characters, the game. And it's one of those films, I mean, I wonder if I even did this with my introduction, but if you try and put it down on paper, it gets quite confusing because you're like, there's so many different characters and they're different types of people, you know, different types of player from the game. And there's a lot more characters going on than what I've mentioned. But I found that it just sort of flowed on screen, and then it all kind of made sense because of the casting and because of the, you know, the way you move through the story, where in a way that it makes more sense when you watch it than it does to try and write down everyone who's involved and their different, you know, abilities and where they come from. I really was won over by this, but I know that you are notoriously not a big fantasy fan, Jane, and you're not a big Lord of the Rings fan or Game of Thrones or anything like that. So as a sort of generally fantasy averse person, how did you find Dungeons and Dragons?
I mean, this is everything I hate. Dragons, like fantasy, different sort of factions and worlds and everything that I would absolutely hate. And I bloody loved it.
Oh, yes.
I found it an absolute hoot. And it was a throwback to sort of the films that I enjoyed as a kid. Like, you know, it has a sort of Romancing the Stone element to it. It's that sort of dare doing and big action pieces, but at the heart, this sort of group of people that are just, you know, trying to get on with their lives. I felt like, breathe a sigh of relief. Comedy is back. Like, this is what I want in my life. Not like stony-faced John Wick for 3 hours. I want a romp. I want fun. I want fat dragons. I want cat people and little baby cats being pulled out.
I love the cat people. Yeah, I love the cat
people. Were amazing. I want, you know, reggae. I've never watched Bridgerton in my life. Reggae is an unknown quantity to me. What an absolute hoot he is in this. This sort of quite pompous but heroic knight. He's just incredibly cool. Justice Smith doing a great accent and being just absolutely hopeless and very, very sweet and vulnerable. Chris Pine, so much more fun in this than Don't Worry, Darling, right? I just, loved it. And Michelle Rodriguez, you know how I feel about her. She once saved me from a falling palm tree. She'll forever be my hero. But She is so great in this. And it feels like she hasn't been given something like this to do, to really show her sort of capabilities, both action and sort of the way that she's so delightful. I mean, the cameo that you talked to the directors about is really quite moving and and cute and so kind as well. That's what I really love about this film as well. It's about, you know, Hugh Grant is a terrible baddie, but one of those moustache twirling and he's having a great time baddies. But it's really about, you know, being kind to yourself, and, you know, this entire sort of backstory that she has is just lovely. I loved the birdie creature that they used to escape, and people sort of shouting his name in disappointment as he flops about. Shapeshifters, the owlbear. Where can I get an owlbear? I want an owlbear.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really liked about it. There's just so much going on. And as kind of, again, discussed in the interview, there's this just sense that the world just feels so much bigger, a bit like, you know, when you watched Star Wars or something like that, that you feel that you're kind of glimpsing this bigger world. And I think they do that really well. And they blend the practical and the visual effects really well. Like, you know, you really get the impression of like real sets, real
production
scenery.
Values are amazing. Yeah.
But then obviously there's obviously some like VFX in there as well. As you mentioned, Hugh Grant, just great, just ridiculously enjoyable. And again, I know I'm just repeating everything I said about Air, but this to me is one of those films that, again, you could sort of show to almost anyone and just have a great time with it. It's just like a kind of family film. I think there's just like, it would be so hard not to enjoy this film, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, your evidence of that as the anti-fantasy person.
I didn't go in with brilliant expectations, but the fact that the cast is so strong made me think that it must have something extra going for it than just a straightforward fantasy. And it does. It's like the greatest sort of late 80s, early 90s movies that we all loved. And just watching it made me feel like a kid again. And thank you very much, Dungeons and Dragons, for that, because I can use all the feeling like a kid again activities you can throw my way. I also found myself thinking, when do I get a sequel? Like, I wasn't like, oh God, there we go, that's open for a sequel. I was like, oh good, because I want more of this. I want them to go to, you know, they pull out at the very beginning on a map and that shows the great scale and scope of this world and the places and the adventures you could go on. And we only sort of are confined to one area, but there's so much potential for more fun here. Yeah, and I'd totally buy a ticket for that.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's potential. And in that sense, I really hope it does well. Not necessarily because, yeah, like I said, it just turns into a massive franchise, but I just hope people appreciate it, because it does feel like something a bit new and a bit different in the sort of blockbuster space at the moment. So, yeah, I just hope people get to see it and enjoy it.
Yeah, support comedy. Go and see comedy, not just the huge sort of spectacles and the huge franchises that are number 13 out of the gate or whatever. Although this is based on existing IP, so it is one of those, I think it's incredibly inventive, incredibly funny, and incredibly warm-hearted. So, yeah, for me, I would go and see this over Air. Would you?
I mean, yeah, if I'm only picking one, yeah, I'd pick this week, yeah, for the cinema especially.
Right, but we're not done yet.
But no.
You know,
strong start to the week.
Strong start. Dungeons and Dragons is out on Friday, but we, you know, there's another kind of gameplay out in the market on a small screen, but, you know, big screen aspirations, it's this.
It's a combination of tetra, Greek for four, and tennis.
Tennis.
The Russian inventor, he likes tennis.
Hazel. Yeah.
This game isn't just addictive. It stays with you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Hank, only 10 other people in the world have seen what you're about to see. It's called the Game Boy.
Package it with Tetris. Can you get us the rights?
So this is Tetris. Matt, you interviewed the lovely star of this. Tell us a bit about it and who stars.
Yes, so I interviewed Taron Egerton for the magazine. Sadly, that's not on this week's episode. That's what one interview that's not on this week's episode. But
you can read that in a print magazine.
Yes, like, you can.
And
you
turn
can read
the pages
and
sniff the ink on those pages. Yeah. Take it with you wherever you go. It's amazing. Print.
And a very nice chap he is too. And obviously, if you know nothing about this film, the idea of a Tetris movie sounds odd, because obviously it's just this falling blocks puzzle game that, like, a bit like Air, you know, everyone's heard of Michael Jordan, everyone is familiar with Tetris, and you probably played it a lot in the 80s, but even if you didn't, you know, you kind of know what it is, you'd know the theme music. It's not really about the game at all. in that sense. It's much more about the rights behind the game and the sort of the battle that this guy, Hink Rogers, had to sort of secure the distribution rights for it. And I realize now, saying this, that it sounds exceptionally dry on paper, this sort of battle of sort of legal disputes about who owns Tetris, who can distribute it, on what platforms can you distribute it. But it is very, very, very entertainingly put together, I thought. And the story involves kind of trips to Russia. There's a lot of tension, a lot of kind of espionage thrown in there. Surprisingly to me, Robert Maxwell plays a big part in this, the famous pension gobbling tycoon. He's in it, played by Roger Allam, sort of buried under lots of impressive prosthetics. Yeah, again, it was one of those films that took me by surprise. Didn't really know quite what to expect. Didn't really know anything about the story. It's quite straightforward in the way it's told. It doesn't feel like something you've never seen before. There's kind of shades of The Social Network there, things like that. But it's just, again, it's just the way it's put together. Very entertaining for me, very hard to dislike. Enjoyable cast, some globe trotting, which I think it was mostly filmed in Scotland, but you know, with some kind of clever doubling going on. There's these little kind of 8-bit animated interludes to kind of keep things sort of snappy. And yeah, there's just a lot of globe trotting, because Henk himself, he sort of actually lives in Japan and has a sort of Japanese family. So, you know, we jump from there to the US, to Soviet Russia. There's all sorts of, as is the case, there's all different elements going on. There's the Nintendo kind of element, and the development of the Game Boy is kind of playing to the background. So again, another film this week that's pushing 80s nostalgia buttons. But also, you know, you're meeting the kind of, you know, the designer of the game and all this kind of stuff. So I thought it was, yeah, very, very entertaining, put together by director John S. Baird, who previously made Filth and Stan and Ollie, two, again, very entertaining films. So in very sort of safe hands with him. But did you like this film, Jane?
Yeah, and I think Baird is really good at really leaning into the style of a film. So like Filth really leaned into that vibe of, you know, everything that we expect from an adaptation of that book, and stylistically so. And the same is true of this. Like, there isn't a single thing that doesn't have a little finessing in terms of music, graphics, interludes that you mentioned, even the way sort of editing is done. It really is all about 80s computer games and that sort of warm nostalgia for them, which is really enticing. And as you describe it, it sounds really quite boring that people sort of go flying around trying to get people to sign contracts. But, you know, this is a complete companion piece to Air. And in fact, I would watch them both this week and see how each director has done something a little bit different, but essentially leaned into that warmth and nostalgia. So yeah, I really enjoyed this. I knew nothing about this story. I had no idea about the Maxwells being so involved, or the Russian sort of black ops that was happening there. And the fact that this was a real wrestle in the 80s between sort of the Iron Curtain in terms of who gets the rights to this game, and what does it mean for it to be taken from Russia and put on a Game Boy, and that this game is what totally changes the fortunes of Nintendo from being, you know, a successful brand to being stratospheric. So in the same, like the Air Jordan shoe, the Game Boy and Tetris, like, you have to have these two magical things together for something to really take off. And it's about the visionaries, the people who can see that potential. So it's Matt Damon in Air, and it's Taron Egerton in this one. And they both are so good at playing that sort of dogged enthusiasm and that desperation and charm that ultimately is what leads them to get the deal, and not the nefarious sort of bloated tycoon who, there is one point that I sort of a bit grimaced at when Kevin Maxwell comes in and says to Daddy, "What's this thing about pensions?" And Daddy goes, "Oh, never mind." And it's like, nobody had that conversation. Like, you know, we get it. We read the news. We understand what Robert Maxwell was, but it felt a little bit like, you know, when people go, "Oh, I hear that this young man called Hitler is starting to get some traction in Austria." You know, it's when people say stuff like that in historical things and you're like, nobody said that. So that annoyed me a little bit. But yeah, I think It's fun. It's fun to watch historical films that aren't about great wars. It's about sort of these moments that are actually life-changing for all of us. We've all had a Game Boy. We've all spent hours and got aching thumbs from it. Mm. It is interesting to see how that came to be.
Yeah, like you say, you definitely get the impression that the sort of drama was pumped up. But at the same time, it doesn't portray itself as a gritty, sort of realistic historical document. It is fun. It is, you know, it is light. And like you say, I thought Taron was really likable in this. Very good accent. Like he's kind of,
he's
sort of largely speaking, you'd say American, because he grew up in America. But he did say to me that he threw in some little Dutch things in there as well, because Henk was actually Dutch. But there was just something. Yeah, he again, like you say, exactly like Matt Damon, that you just really rooted for him and sort of, you know, were willing him to kind of succeed in this sort of scary world that he kind of gets tangled up in, and you're really sort of, you know, hoping he can sort of blag his way through. And like, again, like with Air, I'm just a sucker for scenes where people go into a lab and they sort of show the creation and invention, sort of design of things you know that go on to be massive
iconic
products.
And like, items.
And it did take me back that obviously I was someone who grew up with a Game Boy, Tetris, etc. There's something about it. You think it must have just been so amazing when you saw the first Game Boy like that, and you got to have a go. And it does remind you just what a great game Tetris was, and just how addictive it was. And that's the one thing I feel like the film needed, was it needed to properly go into the Tetris theme music more than it did. I feel like we needed a proper blast of that, which I felt it always holding back slightly, but. That was my one kind of nostalgic complaint. But
you've got other needle drops. I mean, brilliant use of the final countdown.
Yes.
Doesn't love that. Shouting that at a party whilst drinking vodka. Love that.
This is just the week for 80s needle drops as well.
Yeah, totally.
I didn't even think about any of this going into this week's podcast. But yeah, they've just all got so much in common, apart from maybe the last film. Maybe not, but...
Otherwise, this is a week of celebrating underdogs, really enjoying and leaning into comedy, and loving the 80s. I mean, that's just basically, that would be my favourite things all rolled into one.
And I would also throw this into the category that I've put Air and Dungeons and Dragons into, where you could kind of watch it with anyone, like if you had sort of parents around, or, you know, again, people who didn't have any interest in video games, for example. I think throw this on and they'll find something to enjoy in it. And again, it's just, there's something about getting, just like with Air, getting sucked into a world where just something exciting is happening. Something big is about to happen that's going to change, you know, a part of the world as we know it. And, you know, these people are on the cusp of this kind of big change. It's just an exciting sort of thing to sort of play with.
Literal game changers. Well, this one is. Yeah. Okay. So highly recommend this. This is on the small screen. This is available on Apple TV Plus from Friday. So you can watch this on the small screen, then go out to see Air on the biggie, and then throw in a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons whilst you're there. How about it?
What a triple bill.
Right. Shall we keep it with gaming now for our next chat? Yes. Let's look ahead to next week's release. I hope that this will have the same love as we've given Tetris. It's this.
We will destroy the Mushroom Kingdom!
Bowser is coming.
I'm not afraid. I'll do anything for my brother.
We're going to save him.
Yes! Fire!
You asked for it! This is fun!
Here we go!
So this is the Super Mario Brothers movie. Matt, you went to speak to Princess Peach herself.
I did. Anya Taylor-Joy, yes, and very nice she was too. You'll be unsurprised, everyone who's listened thus far, that I was a big Mario Brothers fan growing up. And if I can sort of plug our current issue as well, we've got a feature on the old Super Mario Brothers film, which that was a key film in my childhood. I know, obviously, now I have more complicated feelings about it, but at the time, I just unashamedly loved it, and just didn't realize that it was considered a bad film. But forget that for now, because coming up, there is a much more sort of faithful rendition of, you know, this, the Super Mario Brothers that we know from the games. And the film is actually embargoed until it comes out next week. And so we'll review it on next week's podcast.
We are not allowed to say whether they've managed to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've got to tread a bit carefully. from the trailers, you can see it's a much more faithful rendition of the games. It's obviously computer animated, so Anya's doing the voice of Princess Peach, and you see all the things you kind of expect faithfully rendered. So, you know, you've got Mario and Luigi in there, the plumbers who get sort of sucked into the Mushroom Kingdom. You've got Bowser, voiced by Jack Black,
which is perfect casting.
Yeah, exactly. And you've just got all those kind of colorful visuals you'd expect. You see the sort of Mario Kart elements in the trailer. Just judging from my timeline, my sort of social media timeline, when the first trailer dropped, people went absolutely nuts for it. So I have the feeling this will be a big hit, but we'll obviously have to wait and see. But anyway, before we sort of review the film properly next week, I this week got the chance to speak to Anya Taylor-Joy about it. To sort of begin with, did you grow up with the Super Mario Brothers games, or did you have a lot of research to do once this came your way?
I grew up with it in the sense that my brother played it a lot, but I was always outside. I was just kind of running around like a little hooligan. So when I did get this role, it gave me a wonderful excuse to have a second childhood. So yeah, I'm grateful to Nintendo and Illumination for my second childhood.
Do they give you like a big stack of games to play through as research then?
They gave me some Switches, which I'm terrible at asking for things. And I remember my partner being like, just ask for a Switch. And I was like, I couldn't possibly. He's like, just ask for one. And they sent me two. And I was like, thank you.
And so did you really get into them when you actually started playing then as an adult?
I did. But you know what? I really enjoy playing at the arcade. I think that's such like a fun activity to do with a whole group of people. And I basically work nonstop. And so any excuse to sort of get out and be a bit more hands-on with it. I've really enjoyed going to arcades.
And obviously so much of this film is very faithful to what people have seen in the games, but this is quite a new sort of reinvention of Peach, isn't it, in a way? So could you kind of introduce listeners to this version of Peach?
From the very first meeting that the creators and I had about her, I was really impressed and excited by the fact that we were all on the same page as to who Peach should be in this next era. When I first saw the film, I came out so unbelievably excited and quite moved that this is now somebody that kids can have as a role model. And this is how we're presenting female leadership. I just felt so proud to be a part of that and really, really inspired. And so I'm really proud to be a part of this. Peach is an empowered woman. And if you think about it, and this is when I get really nerdy, if you think about the storyline, it makes more sense that she's strong and in control because she is the ruler of the Mushroom Kingdom. And that's not an easy job. So if she was constantly being plucked out of her castle, she wouldn't be very good at ruling, would she?
And presumably you wouldn't have really been interested if it had have been exactly how she was in those early games when she is just kind of getting taken from one place to the next.
I think we're all looking for characters that are more 3D and have more going on for them. And I think, again, Illumination, Nintendo, the directors have done such a good job of creating a world that still feels inclusive of those who have loved the game from the beginning. And yet it's fresh, it's new. And if you're not somebody that knows the games very well, you can still have an access to it.
And Chris Pratt and Charlie Day the other day, they were kind of saying that it's actually Luigi who kind of occupies the sort of damsel role more than anyone in this film, isn't it? So is that what you thought as well?
Yes, but I also think that that's part of the messaging of the film, which is, you know, Mario and Luigi have such a beautiful relationship that's never quite been explored in this way. And what I see as a takeaway from the film is no matter your differences, if you work together, you're probably going to achieve your goal and it's easier than doing it by yourself. And so I think seeing all these characters in a slightly different light, it hopefully makes the world a little bit brighter.
And did you get to work with Chris and Charlie and Jack Black at all?
No, I wish. If we ever get the chance to do it again, I would love to do it like that because they're so talented and I feel like I could learn so much. But I did get to meet Jack for publicity and I fully fangirled. And that does not happen to me very often at all. I just lost it because, I mean, he's like a hero. He invited me to a Tenacious D concert and I was like, okay, I can die happy.
Would you consider playing Princess Peach in a live action version of this if it ever came up?
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I would love to. Listen, she's the best. I love Peach.
I've got to ask you, you've completed work on Furiosa as well. So is something like that the complete opposite to working on a sort of voiceover role in an animation?
Each film is so, so different. It's like anything in life. Every experience is completely unique. But I actually find it very funny because every time I see Rainbow Road, I'm like, Rainbow Road, Fury Road. I'm just on a road. I'm on a road at some point on some kind of motorized vehicle, probably having a great time. So it's interesting that the two of them have that connection.
Fury Road is one of the most sort of acclaimed films of the last decade or so. How do you think people will find Furiosa in comparison?
The main thing that George and I spoke about was that Fury Road is a road movie. You know, it takes place over, I think, 3 days, getting somewhere and then turning around and coming back. And this is an epic. This takes place over a long period of time and you kind of get to know her better in that way. I love that character so much. That whole experience was mind-boggling and George is the best. So I hope that they enjoy it.
And final question, the Super Mario Brothers movie will probably inspire like a young generation of kind of cinema goers to get into these games. And you've sort of had something similar to that with The Queen's Gambit when that inspired a lot of people to get into chess. Do you get people coming up to you asking you for chess tips?
All the time. And they're so disappointed that I don't carry a chess set with me. And I'm like, I don't think... I'm sorry that I can't fulfill that dream. No, but you are making me laugh because I'm like, am I just the game girl?
So that's Anya Taylor-Joy on the Super Mario Brothers movie, which is out in cinemas on the 5th of April, and we'll review it on next week's pod. But before we get to that, we've got one more film to look at for this week. It's the latest from Paul Mescal, who is an Oscar nominee now.
There's been a claim made by a young woman. Brian says he was at home with you that night. Is that right?
He was, yeah. We both know that's a lie, though.
This is a serious accusation.
You don't want to hear her side?
You laughed at Olive about how long?
Usual family traits, boys being boys.
Was there anyone else out? Do you remember?
Couldn't tell you.
Everyone's got their eyes closed.
So this is God's Creatures, starring Paul Mescal and Emily Watson. Matt, who are they playing?
So they are a mother and son. Emily Watson is Aileen, who works in this seafood sort of factory.
A fish factory?
Yeah, fish factory, yeah, in a sort of Irish sort of fishing village. Basically, there's a death there. So as one of the fishermen kind of drowns. And at the funeral, Brian, who played by Paul Mescal, returns. And he's been away for a long time in Australia. Even from there, there's this strange sort of tension. It's like we don't quite know why he went to Australia. I couldn't quite gather how long he'd been there, although it's clearly been some time. His return clearly took people by surprise, and it's sort of partly a kind of prodigal son type return. Like the mother's obviously clearly sort of very happy to have him back, but he brings this kind of tension with him and this kind of thing hanging in the air that, you know, you don't quite know what's going to happen. You don't know quite what has happened to him. And then he sort of gets involved in some slightly dodgy dealings in terms of this local kind of, you know, fishing and seafood kind of business. So then following this, there's like, I'll say an incident happens and a lie is told. And then we kind of see the fallout from that. And in a change from all the films that we've discussed so far this week, this is sort of much darker, much more brooding. This isn't the sort of the light, frothy film I would say throw on for anyone. I personally, there were things I enjoyed about it. It has a real kind of foreboding mood. Emily Watson and Paul Mescal were sort of both really good in it. I really do rate Paul Mescal and like love seeing the stuff he's done since Normal People, the sort of choices he makes and the material that he's clearly drawn towards. And, you know, another key cast member is Aisling Francozzi, who's a young woman who works in this fishing plant. And again, she kind of turns out to be central to the story. And it's, yeah, it was one of those weird films for me where I loved the sense of place. It feels really kind of isolated. It feels really claustrophobic. The wind is kind of constantly howling. There's this constant sense of dread. And there was this moment as well. I don't know if you thought this as well, Jane, or if this was a sort of a metaphorical overstretch for me, but there's a moment where, you know, where we learn about the oysters being kind of tainted, let's say that. I can't remember the exact words used. And so they have to kind of get rid of them all. And that to me was sort of metaphorical for the film, where there's this thing that kind of poisons and spreads out and sort of, you know, affects everyone. For all those kind of qualities I've mentioned, I never felt 100% gripped by it, if you know what I mean. I never felt like, I don't know, I was waiting for a sort of, you know, like a real killer moment to really, like, you know, seal the deal for me. But it was more just like, I was like, yeah, this is interesting. I really like what they're doing with the kind of, you know, sense of place and everything. But I didn't ever fully feel like I was just 100% engaged and 100% gripped, if you know what I mean. But how did you find it?
I loved this. Thought this was purely Shakespearean in the timelessness of it, and the fact that you actually don't really know what era this is in. Like, nobody uses a mobile phone. There's nothing to suggest that it's not right now or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You could put them in Victorian garb and play this the same way, pretty much. It would play the same. It has this timeless, tragic quality to it that I really, really liked. This wonderful pervading sense of doom that, as you say, this, that something is in the water, something is coming. There's something poisonous within this community. And we obviously, not to say who or what that is, but that it has absolutely sort of dire consequences by appearing. I loved that idea that this film is a very quiet film. It's not any big dramatic moments, but it's like the cold and the seawater that we see so much of. It's dank, it seeps into you and you feel the chill by the end. You don't realize how cold you've got whilst watching this film. It's a film that absolutely haunted me. I'm still thinking about it, having seen it. Paul Mescal, I think, is, you know, this is very different from the role he's been lauded for. He's playing troubled, but he's as slippery as any of the fish that he is stealing from nets at night. He's really very interesting to watch. And it sort of explores all sorts of themes, from how much you do as a mother to protect your child, how far away from your community you can go before you're lured back, whether some people shouldn't be part of a community, nature versus nurture. Is there such a thing as a wrong'un? You know, all of those things. I mean, and it also really, really puts you off smoking. I mean, there is so much smoking in this film. I couldn't believe it. So yeah, from that point of view. So you end up having watched this film feeling cold and damp, and like you've been in a sort of nicotine fug with these people, and smelling of fish. It's almost like you can smell the sea, the brine, the fish. It feels very visceral. So as a sort of mood piece, I think it's exceptional.
As a mood piece, yes, I agree with pretty much all that. And it almost have that kind of ASMR quality for me as well, in a way, with the wind and it being just so dark there. You know, there's lots of interesting little kind of side characters and things, and, you know, like, haven't really kind of dug into the relationship with Brian and his dad, but that's kind of like an interesting sort of theme of the film as well. But yeah, like I say, I mean, it's a film, because I sort of rated those qualities so highly, I would give it another go at some point, but I just didn't, just never felt as entirely gripped by the story. But I wasn't as kind of, in terms of momentum and things, I wasn't as pulled along as I thought I'd be, and perhaps wasn't as affected by the, you know, the outcome as I thought I might be. But yeah, still an impressive piece of work for sure.
Yeah, it made me think about eating oysters again as well.
Yeah, I can take or leave oysters. I'm not the biggest fan. So
I ordered an oyster once. Do you remember, a few months ago, and it had spawned.
Oh,
and that's a thing. So yeah, this combined with a spawning oyster has kind of put me off them. But yeah, the sort of hardship of that life is very clearly sort of sketched here, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. You really get that vibe, and again, just how it's just sort of part of the fabric of the town. That's just what it is, this fishing town. So it's just everything revolves around it, and everything's kind of knitted together because of it. And I don't know if this is sort of patronizing to say, but yeah, I don't know if I'd say hard scrabble existence, but yeah, it's kind of, that's just what the people there do, basically. You know, you feel like they're kind of born into it almost, you know. And there's a sense you can't escape it, but Brian obviously did for a while, but you know, was kind of drawn back. That's kind of interesting. And again, I think things I found interesting about, you know, people he knew in the past and people who have left and haven't. And that, and there was, like I say, there was just loads of interesting things going on, even if I was never, you know, never fully dragged along by the plot in the way I sort of hoped to be.
Yeah. And that whole idea, you know, at the beginning that the fisherman had drowned because the tradition there is for fishermen not to learn to swim. And that very sort of old fashioned, passed down from generation to generation, that it's better to not learn so that if you fall in, you drown and you don't struggle and drown, because that's worse. And whether that's sort of all linked to sort of superstition as well, and all of that plays into this. So yeah, I thought it was like reading a book. That richness for me worked really, really well. So yeah, not your film of the week then?
No.
What is your film of the week?
But it's just a strong week overall. I would have to say I'd recommend all of them, but I'd say Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves would be my pick of the week, especially, you know, if you're wanting to get out to the cinema, that would be the one for me.
I mean, I think God's Creatures and Dungeons and Dragons, I can't believe I'm saying it, are the cinema treats for me. I would go and see those for wildly different reasons and wildly different experiences. And maybe what you should do is start with God's Creatures, and then when you need to have a little palate cleanser pick-me-up from the dankness of that, try out Dungeons and Dragons and have a hoot.
You definitely want to do it in that order.
Not the other way around. Yeah.
No.
Because that might be quite a sad weekend if you do. Cool. Okay. So a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and we'll appear like magic. We should also mention what's appearing like magic on Newsstand. What have we got on the cover?
The new issue of Total Film featuring Fast X, which I've just realised now, saying this aloud, do we actually say Fast X or do we say Fast 10? I've always said Fast X in my head.
I thought it was Fast X, but now you've put me in a quandary of thinking, are we supposed to view it as a Roman numeral and say 10? I don't know.
We don't say Rocky V, do we? We don't say Rocky V.
No. But Fast X,
I think Fast
sounds
X sounds
sexy.
Cooler. Yeah, it sounds turbocharged. It sounds cool. And as the franchise is sort of coming to an end, they're not kind of slowing down in terms of throwing new elements in there. So Jordan Farley, who did this feature, he spoke to Vin Diesel, Louis Leterrier, the director, and then newcomers Jason Momoa and Brie Larson, who, like, you know, they've added just a couple of superstar superheroes to the mix. And it had a very, very rocky road to the screen. So it's genuinely is a really, really great read. And also, I mean, if I do say so myself, it is a very jam-packed issue. There's loads of other stuff going on, including Citadel, the Russo brothers' new Spyverse TV show. I spoke to Dexter Fletcher and Chris Evans about Ghosted. There's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in there. Stephen Yeun's in there. The Super Mario Brothers 1993 piece that I mentioned's in there. There's a career interview with John
Boyega.
There's an absolutely
essential piece on the DCU. Your good self,
okay.
that tells you what you need to look out for in the next phase, considering it's all just gone to hell in a handcart and everyone's sacked. Bob Odenkirk's in there, Barry Cogan. I mean, loads of stuff.
It's jam-packed and it's out now as you listen to this.
It's out now. Go fetch it. Run. Don't walk. Go fetch it. Right, it is time to go. But before we do, it's time for a listener's question. And this is kind of, you know, valid for God's Creatures, I'd say. Who is the best on-screen crier? Who tears up like a champ?
Paul Mescal did some great crying in Normal People. This is a really difficult question, I suppose, because so many, I don't know, yes, it's hard to narrow down. But if I have to do that thing of going on instinct of the first thing that popped into my head when this question was asked, and I'll go for Florence Pugh. Just simply because, not only because I just think she's sort of, you know, an amazing actor, but the image of her in Midsommar that was on all the posters.
Oh, yeah, bawling.
That was just such an amazing scene and just so memorable. That was what sprung to mind when I thought of that. So she will take my crown there, the flower crown, if you will.
Okay.
How about you?
I like to see a man cry. I think it's great when men cry on screen and show vulnerability. So I think James McAvoy has always been extremely good at doing that. And, you know, his eyes filling and showing his vulnerability. I think Timothy Chalamet is also extremely good at that. Call Me By Your Name, when he cries in front of the fireplace and goes through this entire range of emotions whilst the credits roll is amazing. But, you know, I also really love it when people ugly cry on screen, because they don't all just have a beautiful tear that slides down our face. So Juliet Stevenson in Truly Madly Deeply, when she's mourning the loss of Alan Rickman and she's at the therapist and she's saying, I'm so angry with him. And there's snot coming down her nose in great big sort of strings of snot, and she's weeping and she's bawling and crying. I mean, that's what sort of Miss Flo does well as well. The sort of the idea of that, you know, people don't cry quietly and beautifully. They do sob. So, yeah, those would be my picks.
Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio does some masterful crying in Romeo and Juliet as well. Just
That's
another one that sprung to mind.
Yeah. Love it. Okay. I do love a blub on screen. And it's one of those things that's like, you know, makes you do it as well, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
When people howl, it does something visceral. It's like when you smell puke in the school corridor and you immediately heave. It's that sort of triggering thing. So yeah, I love a bit of a cry on screen. Okay, so on that note, we shall say our goodbyes, but we will be back next week. I won't. You will be back, won't you, Matt?
I'll be holding down the fort, yes, with Jordan. So yeah, and we're going to be reviewing Super Mario Brothers movie, Lola and Falcon Lake.
Yes, I will be in New York. I will be reenacting The Journey of the Warriors. So that's what I'm going to be doing. Not for work, simply because I absolutely want to. I'll be getting some Coke bottles for that final scene at Coney Island. Might wear rollerblades or a baseball outfit. Don't know yet. We'll see. But that's what I'll be doing. So you have a good time on the pod, Matt. I'll have a good time in New York. And for now, I think we'll say goodbye. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.